Okay, and finally, on this panel, we have Chris McDonald. Sounds like a disaster. Music and rhetoric in Atlantic Canadian disaster response.
All right, so Heather unfortunately didn't get to play any music for you, but that will fall on my shoulders. I'll go through a few songs with you and talk a bit about these things. Trauma, pain, and disaster, experienced individually or collectively, have a long history of expression in song. Disaster songs emerge from traumatic events and merit study for how they express, manage, and mediate social and personal trauma. Recent studies by Sparling, Scanlon, and others of disaster songs in Atlantic Canada reveal a rich and ongoing process of amateur and semi-professional songwriting, which extends down to the present day. While the lyrics of these songs have been studied for a variety of purposes, the musical and oral aspects have not been discussed in any detail. This paper looks at musical sound structure and rhetoric in selected songs about Atlantic Canadian disasters, and considers how the music mediates sentiments towards the disaster and shapes collective memories of the events. One interesting aspect of these songs is that trauma is not expressed directly in the music of many of them. The layers of emotion and rhetoric are more often made to serve other ends and reflect a multifaceted relationship to the past. For the purposes of the current study, I've chosen three songs with very different musical and rhetorical approaches, each referencing disasters in Nova Scotia. Two of them concern the 1958 coal mining disaster at Spring Hill, the first being Peggy Seeger's and Ewan McCall's The Ballad of Spring Hill, that's from 1959, and the second being Brian Vardigan's Spring Hill, which is from 2009. The third, a song by Alberta singer-songwriter James Keelahan, references a 1989 shipwreck off the coast of Cape Breton and is named after the ship, the Captain Torres, and that's from 1999. Contrasts and commonalities among all these songs will provide good opportunities for discussing the different musical and rhetorical strategies that make for effective disaster-themed songs. To provide some background on the first two songs, I'll consider the history of the 1958 Spring Hill mining disaster. On October 23, 1958, a geological phenomenon known in mining as a bump occurred, in which pressure under the earth is released through a small tremor and shifting of the earth. In coal mining, this can cause shafts to collapse and to be cut off from the surface and toxic gases to be released. In Spring Hill, the bump killed 74 men almost instantly and left about 100 men trapped below. Rescue efforts brought back 81 miners the next day, but others trapped below had to wait a week and some as long as 9 days to be dug out. It was expected that few would have survived this long underground, but 19 in all were rescued. Perhaps not surprisingly, many songs about this event emphasize the miracle of finding living miners after so many days had passed, but the event, killing 75 miners in total and leading to the end of Spring Hill's years as an industrial mining town, were crushing blows to the region. Peggy Seeger's and Ewan McCall's Ballad of Spring Hill was among the first of several songs to be written in the wake of the disaster. The song was something of a milestone for Seeger, whose forays into folk-style songwriting had been hitherto a mixed success. Moving away from using old-fashioned ballad-like vocabulary, Seeger wrote the Ballad of Spring Hill in a more contemporary poetic idiom about a current event. As Lydia Hammersley argues, quote, Peggy found a successful voice by freely combining a folk music idiom, a song that sounds like an old folk song, with language and situations that were contemporary and very often about very specific people and events, end quote. This begs the question of how Seeger made a contemporary song that sounds like an older folk song and how this contributes to the rhetoric of the song. So I'm going to play just a couple of verses to get the sound in your ear.
In the town of Spring Hill, Nova Scotia, down in the dark of the Cumberland mine, there's blood and the coal and the miners lie in the roads that never saw sun or sky, roads that never saw sun or sky. In the town of Spring Hill, you don't sleep easy. Often the earth will tremble and roll. When the earth is restless, miners die. Bone and blood is the price of coal. Bone and blood is the price of coal.
Okay. For Hemesley, Seeger uses the significant experience, her significant experience with traditional song, which she obtained from her father, Charles Seeger, and mother, Ruth Crawford Seeger, to imitate the form and shape of a folk melody. The choice of a well-inflected Dorian mode, a rising fifth in the opening phrase, and the use of the high register in the middle two phrases are all typical of the older ballads that Seeger grew up hearing and singing. Her choice of having each stanza end on the dominant note and a minor dominant chord was meant to give the song a kind of circularity typical of some ballads, an effect that Seeger herself called keep-goingness or never-endingness. The vocal delivery is also a key part of the song's rhetoric, with Seeger and McCall singing in a very unadorned and measured way, as if to capture the stoic and plain delivery of traditional ballad singing. Their voices are also quite strong and assertive, and at times even strident, and the emphatic delivery and even delivery of the melody's square rhythms are almost militant. The voices sound as if they could accompany marching. Seeger then constructed a disaster song as a folk song tied to an older working class and peasant tradition, giving it an almost historic sensibility. Although it was about a then-current event, the song sounds like a public record of something that happened long ago. Meanwhile, the militant vocal delivery, the stridence of which barely suggests a barely veiled anger or outrage, politicizes the event. The lyrics occasionally speak of the exploitive aspect of a dangerous occupation like mining, for example, blood and bone is the price of coal, but the song's urgent vocal delivery provides an oral sign of political criticism that runs throughout the song. Despite these features, the song includes some aspects to the vocal arrangement, including varying harmonies, trading of lead vocals between Seeger and McCall. These both reflected the rigorous, trained professionalism of Seeger's musical background, as well as an awareness that, in order to create a viable commercial recording, variation was needed to keep the song's strophic form from becoming too repetitive. Although it does not overwhelm other aspects of the song's rhetoric, it does indicate that other priorities existed in the arranging and recording of the song. These aspects certainly paid off in terms of making the song a successful labor-based protest song during the folk revival of the 1950s and 60s. As Neil Rosenberg notes, Seeger's Ballad of Spring Hill became the most well-known musical document of the disaster throughout Canada and the rest of the Anglo-American world, so much so that many Canadians came to think of that it was, in fact, a Nova Scotia folk song. Moreover, its musical mediation of the event, says Rosenberg, flattered middle-class folk revivalist tastes. Quote, unlike other songs that are in the style of 1950s country music, this song's stark imagery and haunting modal melody convey a sense of tragedy in terms compatible with elite music aesthetics. And its text, referring to the inherent danger of a natural resources-based industry, artfully objectifies the tragedy in elegant ballad impersonality, end quote. Okay. An interesting contrast is provided by a song about the same event written by singer-songwriter Brian Vardigans of Kentville, Nova Scotia. Written from the perspective of the late 2000s, the song Spring Hill, which is subtitled These Are Green Hills Now, intersperses the scenic pastoral present of the town with its gritty industrial past. In the first stanza, clean air, green pastures, and remodeled houses are contrasted with memories of miners' darkened faces and a polluted landscape. In the second stanza, the town's present status as a tourist stop and the hometown of Anne Murray is contrasted with the 1958 disaster, where, with rescuers or draggermen anxiously searching for survivors. And finally, Vardigan describes the loss of the mining industry in the wake of the disaster, which was partly replaced with the Spring Hill Corrections Facility, and compares today's above-ground prison with yesterday's below-ground prison. So I'll play a little bit of this one.
These are green hills now. This is air you can breathe. And the small miners' homes are all painted up and sheathed. But when I was a child, you know that wasn't so. There was coal dust up above and coal dust down below. And the dark miners' faces were as common as a penny. And now 50 years later, you won't find any. These are green hills now. It's a drive-through now.
Let's stop it there. Vardigan's alternating descriptions of past and present are fragments and don't quite add up to the stories from which they draw. Spring Hill's present and past are almost in dialogue in this piece, with the traumas of the past impinging on the protagonist's consciousness as he reflects on what Spring Hill is now. On one level, I think this reflects Maria Chismic's findings regarding music and trauma. For Chismic, the psychology of trauma is reflected in musical presentations of it, where fragments of the past are brought into play in partial and sometimes non-narrative ways. This reflects the way that traumatic memories surface in individuals, often unexpected and uninvited, and thus the past intrudes into the present, blurring distinctions between them. Chismic discusses this with respect to modern European instrumental classical music works, which are thematically focused on war-related trauma. And the way she performed her more detailed musical analysis does not map directly onto the oral dimensions of a singer-songwriter piece like Vardigan's. However, it does make sense of the way he structured the lyrics, and some points can be made about how the music supports this. The song is based entirely on a pentatonic melody, and Vardigan sets up a back-and-forth movement between two potential tonic chords, A minor and C major. The sense of the melody's modality during the first eight lines of the stanza is not conclusive, and the back-and-forth between major and minor, with no other chords acting as dominants or neighbors to add further context, inflects the melody with two different affects, perhaps reflecting a vexed past with a more bucolic present. The next four lines appear to establish the modality as minor, with each line featuring a G major and A minor chord. But the concluding line, "These are green hills now," closes off the stanza in a strong dominant tonic cadence in C major. The major-minor transitions, although not in sync with the imagery of the lyrics, seems to imply two different memories and affects alternating and impinging on each other. Vardigan's vocals also present a significant contrast with Seeger's and McCall's in the Ballad of Spring Hill. Much closer to speech and rhythm, Vardigan's vocals present no militancy or stridency, but creates a much more confessional and vulnerable sense, with its moderate level of breath support and rapid quivering vibrato. The stanzas are lyrically dense, and this leads the vocal delivery to be rhythmically busy without much place for pausing until the final line. This text heaviness is appropriate to the act of confessing, of speaking of trauma and letting out in a torrent what has been held inside. The rhetorical effect is not one of drama, but one of personal private monologue in which the dramatic pauses or rhythmic emphasis on certain words is unnecessary. The only exception to this is the final line of each stanza, where the "Green Hills Now" lyric closes off the flow of memory in long lingering notes, and the present landscape again covers over the past events that Vardigan describes. The last song I want to discuss describes a maritime disaster, the sinking of a Vanuatu-registered cargo ship called the Captain Torres off the coast of Cape Breton Island in 1989. The song bearing the ship's name was recorded by Winnipeg-based singer-songwriter James Keelahan in 1999. This disaster happened the same week as the massacre of women at Montreal's École Polytechnique and was overshadowed in the news as a result. During a violent storm in the Cabot Strait, the crew of the ship radioed for help to the Coast Guard in Sydney, only to be told that the storm was too intense to send out helicopters or boats to help. After being hit by a rogue wave, the ship was crippled and began sinking, and the crew again radioed to Sydney, asking if they could be patched into their families to say goodbye. The Coast Guard did this, and each of the ship's 39 crew members lined up to make one last two-minute phone call to their families. Keelahan was urged by his sister to write about this disaster after she heard a show on CBC Radio discussing it. The disaster, as narrated by Cape Breton author Silver Donald Cameron in his book Wind, Whales, and Whiskey, was Keelahan's main source for the song. Keelahan composed the chord progressions first and searched for a story and a lyrical hook that would mesh well with them. The tagline to each main stanza is in French, reflecting the fact that the crew of the Captain Torres was francophone, and this was the first phrase that Keelahan put to music. The phrase, "La mer n'a pas d'empas," the sea is unforgiving, is used dramatically as the cry of the sailors, although this is Keelahan taking artistic license. In Silver Donald Cameron's account, the phrase was uttered by a relative of one of the sailors as he laid a wreath on the Cabot Strait in their memory. The song is set in E minor, and the main melody is again pentatonic, except for the tagline, where the melody and chords use the harmonic minor scale to create an unambiguous sense of closure. The bridge shifts into G major, with the key change amplifying Keelahan's twist in the narrative, and that's do I count myself lucky, that at this top of the second column. Until the bridge is unclear who is recounting the loss of the Captain Torres, but the bridge reveals it to be one of the sailor's wives taking one of the 2-minute phone calls. So I'll play a bit of this song.
Small Captain Torres, how high the sea, gale 10, engines failing, no quarter, no leave. They know when the wrong wave hits them. Perdu, they're gone. They've played their share of poker. They know odds are long. La mer me parle d'un pas. La mer me parle.
Captain Torres was conceived by Keelahan as a dramatic narrative, and one salient expressive technique that he uses in the song is that of carefully placed pauses. These pauses are not just interpretive details, but are composed into the structure of the song. Many of the lyrical phrases contain nouns and adjectives or adverbs unconnected by verbs, which are held to be understood. For example, the opening line, "How small," pause, "the Captain Torres," omits the verb is for dramatic purposes, and the vocal pause is used to add its rhetorical effect. This kind of rhetoric is used throughout much of the song, except for the tagline, which is treated as a complete musical and lyrical thought, and in contrast with the rest of the verse. There are also places where Keelahan sings across that pause, either because of the number of syllables or because the line is contextual and does not need to be overly dramatic. For example, the line, "Signals flash, ship to shore," is sung without much of a pause, but the previous line, "Each makes," pause, "one call," is given a long pause to add drama to a pivotal moment. In his study of singing and rhetoric, Robert Toft calls attention to this kind of singing strategy, noting that, quote, "Ordinary pauses serve principally for grammatical discrimination, whereas rhetorical pauses are placed either before or after important matter in order to leave it impressed on the memory with stronger effect," end quote. This is consistent with Keelahan's larger aim, to tell a compelling and poignant story with the kind of verbal rhetoric that brings out the drama of the narrative. So in conclusion, all three songs tell stories of disasters in Atlantic Canada, and they each use lyrical and musical meaning to shape particular feelings and sentiments with respect to them. Considering how songs about occupational disasters allow us to think about how disasters matter to people, and what it means to mediate them through expressive culture like song. Disasters have political meaning, they have personal meaning, and they can shape a region's identity, and they can operate as compelling human drama. Any of these meanings can be created and amplified through musical gesture and sound as well as lyrics, as I hope I have shown here. But other considerations enter into the equation as well, such as the need to arrange songs in such a way that they sound like viable commercial recordings. In the case of Seeger's Ballad of Spring Hill, the presentation of the mining tragedy as a case in point for a particular militant political agenda was evident in the vocal delivery and in the attempt to create a folk song of the people, which nevertheless reflected sentimental middle-class notions of what the people's music should sound like. Brian Vardigan's Spring Hill presented the perspective of a local resident, where recollections of the past color the perception of Spring Hill's present and impinge on each other in an unpredictable rhythm of traumatic personal and historical memory. Meanwhile, James Keelahan's Captain Torres presents a moving but carefully staged drama using verbal and musical rhetoric to capture the compelling story of sailors making their last calls to their families. Each of these musical settings draw from folk revival and singer-songwriter conventions, sharing much in their melodic idioms, but they still use divergent musical and rhetorical strategies, which ultimately reflect the different audiences and purposes which the artist served. And that's it. Thank you. Christia?
I'm really intrigued by your discussion about, you know, sort of pastoral imagery and musical tropes. I mean, one of the places where I feel like I encounter this much more is in the British pastoralists who are doing very specific things with memory past ideas, the present, obviously, you know, symphonic composers doing very different jobs. And obviously they're drawing upon, you know, British folk music in a symphonic kind of context. And I wonder if you could talk more broadly about these pastoral tropes and the kind of work that they do in these songs.
That's interesting, yeah, because I mean, one of the things that I know Vardigans was trying to get across is that, you know, Nova Scotia has this strong industrial past and, you know, this history of labor unrest, and it's been rebranded as this place of pastoral landscapes, clean air, abiding traditions from the past, usually musical and crafts and artifacts and things like that. And obviously music can play a real role in that. And I think that, you know, the sense of the rustic, you know, comes out somewhat in the ballad singing and in the Gaelic language and in the fiddling and things like that. So that's not exactly going the direction I think you're thinking of with the symphonic presentation of these folk songs, but I mean, they are nevertheless being staged and presented in some way, so.
And actually what you're saying is resonating for me, because of course the pastoral tradition is a marker of modernity. It's responding to a modernized, you know, Britain full of labor unrest, and it's this sort of rethinking of Britain, even though it's being, you know, it's this highly industrialized country, as celebrating a rural past and the countryside. Mm-hmm. And, you know, actually, I see those parallels played out in really interesting ways in the East Coast.
That's interesting. And the other thing, too, is that this is also something that Nova Scotia is responding to for deindustrialization, because those modernities have left them. And they're left to, you know, forge new economies, and one of those can be cultural, and one thing that they have that's distinctive are these associations with the past. So, and a lot of Nova Scotians rue that and want to say we also have very modern music and things like that, but it nonetheless is an important trope for the province. Yeah.
It's not really a question, I'm just realizing I should have asked you my question about musical rhetoric for songs about more modern disasters. I don't want to take you away from what you presented here, which is... But yeah, that idea of like Nova Scotia having more modern musical style and soundscape, do you encounter that in other songs?
That's a good question. I mean, Heather and I will really have to talk about that, because I mean, we've really, you know, dove into the mining and the shipwreck disasters, and certainly I was thinking of the Ocean Ranger disaster. One very interesting disaster song that Heather found recently was basically an extreme metal band that wrote about this. So, I mean, there's your example of something that really departs from singer-songwriter and folk revivalist kind of things. Whether that's a general pattern or not, we would have to talk about that. I'm not really sure if that's...
There's this nostalgia and melancholy. There's all of this, right? And these old-fashioned styles. And as you say, it's a deindustrialization and lament. It's fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah, Ryan?
There's also this idea that, like, that there's continuity of instrumentation to some degree, because the same instrumentation, the acoustic guitar, the fiddle, that can apply in folk music also applies to our sort of imagined, touristy Celtic, you know, now how we're presented in terms of the industry. So there is some continuity of tools.
Right.
That mm-hmm. kind of both musical kind of traditions.
Yeah.
The
fiddle is the new coal. Yeah, we were kind of responding to that. Art is the new steel. Yeah, yeah. And it's funny, just putting on my other hat, studying the Cape Breton fiddle tradition, where the accompaniment is primarily piano. It's not acoustic guitar, and yet that's how sort of, you know, held up as the emblematic sort of folk instrument. You're all worn out of disaster songs for now.
Yeah.
Anyways, well, thank you all for your attention.
Yeah.